This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, auguries and omens, the symbolism of birds in mythology and speculative fiction.
Now, again, I'm pretty sure this is an episode which has been in the background of our minds for a while. Most specifically because Jules and I just really like birds.
Yeah, that's fair. And obviously there's a lot of bird mythology out there.
Yeah.
As well. Okay, well, I'll start off by just taking a brief whistle-stop tour through ornithomancy, augury, and omen, and what they all mean and how they all differ.
Yes.
Because actually they're not the same thing. Although technically the others come under ornithomancy. Ornithomancy is basically divination using birds. Not bird entrails, but actual birds, live birds.
No birds are harmed during the divination process.
Yes, certainly, ideally, no birds are harmed. And it can be as simple as if you go back to ancient Rome, Rome was very big on ornithomancy, so releasing a cage full of white pigeons at the right time, or a cage full of crows or whatever, looking at how the birds then acted, there's some really funny ancient Roman divination which I will bring up later, actually. It's just suddenly popped back in my head. But basically looking at how the birds acted was supposed to give you an idea of how things were going to pan out on whatever your question was. Obviously the thing with ornithomancy, and in fact all forms of divination, is that you are looking at other objects, if you like, and interpreting them. So ultimately the idea with divination is that all the answers actually come from you. So yeah. If you're looking at yarrow sticks or a pattern of runestones or tarot cards or what have you, the thought is that all the answers are already within your grasp. It's just these are designed in order to help you grasp these particular answers. Whether you put any credit behind it or not, it's still quite fascinating to look at the various different things. And, you know, as Hermione says in the Harry Potter series, it's a very imprecise branch of magic. And it is the sort of thing that takes a lot of practice, which is why generally in ancient Rome you had your priests and priestesses who would release the birds and then tell you what their flight patterns actually meant. Which brings us on to augury. Augury is the ability to divine the future or answer a question looking at the flight patterns of birds.
Right.
Which sounds a little bit, I suppose, on the surface, kind of sounds a bit nuts, really. But very specific birds were kind of used, your big birds, particularly things like vultures and eagles. In Rome, that is, crows. Big swarms of starlings. Have you ever seen starlings properly form a murmuration?
Oh, it's amazing.
It's amazing. And as you said, and it's also kind of eerie. If the first time you see it, they make such strange dark shapes in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And physicists still don't know how they manage to do it. It's still a mystery why they actually do it. No one's really come up with a good reason why it actually happens. Although, you know, a lot of biologists have managed to get some good dissertations out of trying to follow the likelihood of why. And it is an amazing thing to watch. So you can see why people would then look at things like that and think, oh, I must be able to define the future in that seeming mass of dark chaos there.
Yeah, or it must be a message of some kind.
Omens.
Particularly in a world, you know, which is based on gods and goddesses and...
Yeah, absolutely.
Tricksy animals which have a large connection, all sorts of tricksy deities which have a lot of connection with the natural world.
And omens, the final thing, and an omen when it comes to bird divination and symbolism generally means, you know, you perhaps got something on your mind and a bird pops up at the right time to give you an answer to a question, or you're seeking an answer and you hear a certain bird cry or what have you, or perhaps you see a bird, the right sort of bird, the wrong sort of bird even. You're more likely to recognise the wrong sort of bird in front of you. So it's not necessarily analysing flight patterns. It's more being tuned into nature around you as it stands.
Yeah.
It's, and it's interpreting of bird omens is more practiced by regular pagans today, and obviously it has its roots in Celtic mythology and divination.
It's also less with the others, you know, that you are purposefully going out to look for the future or to look for a message, whereas bird omens, just when it comes to omens, they sort of end up coming to you rather than the other way around.
Yes, and they might present themselves as birds in dreams or in real life as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be a real live bird. It can be the product of your imagination.
Yeah.
So, that's a little bit of background about what we mean by auguries and omens.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to look to start with at some of the birds that come up commonly. I'm mostly going from Celtic, Norse and sort of Irish, Welsh, Brythonic mythology.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is that the same bird in different parts of the world can have a completely opposite meaning. So it depends where you are and the culture you're surrounded by. So I'm going to go with basically what I know.
Yeah, I think we will probably stick to the kind of the British Isles sort of area for this episode, because it is such a humongous topic. And unlike when we were doing episodes on things like cats or horses or things like that, because there are so many different types of birds and so many different ways in which they can be read, it would be very impractical for us to try and cover it all in 1 hour. So we may very well revisit this episode or this subject in terms of how birds are used and viewed in parts of Asia and in the Americas. But for now, let's stick to the British Isles.
Yes, with it, obviously, just before we go a bit further, just because this is so funny, I need to mention it. Rome and sort of and Italy in the old days. Just going back to the auguries and omens, you had your osiers, which were ravens, crows, owls, chickens, apparently, for some reason lumped in with all these predatory birds.
I don't know. I've met chickens. They're predators. They're lethal.
They are vicious and they are little dinosaurs, but they're not exactly majestic or awe-inspiring, are they?
No, I guess not.
But anyway, your osiers, song and behaviour was interpreted, and that's how they got their messages. You have your eyelets, which are eagles, vultures, hawks, etc. Their actions and flight patterns. So they weren't really looking at them perched on branches. They were kind of looking at them in the sky and how they behaved. Mm. There's a story about how two eagles were fighting above, the main sort of Palladium type area in Rome, just sort of around. It was towards the end of the Augustus's rule. He was starting to get a bit erratic. And the young Claudius, who later became emperor, despite the fact that he had a club foot and a stutter and people thought he was a moron, was sort of sat out in one of these gardens, and there were two eagles fighting over something, and one attacked the other, and the eagle dropped what it was carrying, and a wolf pup was just literally fell into Claudius's lap. And obviously they took that as a big symbol, and it could have really endangered Claudius's life if they hadn't kind of hushed it up a little bit, because obviously Rome was supposedly founded on by Romulus, who was one of the twins who was suckled by a she-wolf, Lupa, who was considered one of the sacred animals of Rome. So the fact that this wounded wolf was given to Claudius to look after by two eagles, symbols of the Caesars, was seen as somehow this idiot boy is going to end up being emperor.
And he did.
And he did, in fact. He did. There was lots of prophecies about Claudius. Anyway, so that's your sort of elites type thing. That was a very extreme one. Generally, just seeing the bird wheeling in the sky was supposed to be enough. And this is the one that I think is really bizarre. Extripudus, which is when you... Sorry, this is so silly. It's you interpret the dances of feeding birds and use them to determine military manoeuvres. For such reason, the Roman armies took cages of chickens with them when they were on the move, and they would have someone specially looking as sort of the chicken keeper, and basically a soothsayer who could interpret the movements of the birds. And there would be a ritual feeding, and the soothsayer would say, oh, we need to do this with the armies, etc., based on the movements of the chickens.
Either this soothsayer was just an incredible tactician who wouldn't have been able to get in otherwise, or there's something in it, because, like, the Roman military did pretty well, to be honest.
They did, I
swear. That's kind of alarming.
Yeah, it might have all been down to chickens. Maybe that was it. Maybe chickens had a master plan against us. And
Trump hear this.
And it was a case of no. Look sharp, ladies. We've got to move in this way in order to get the armies to do this. And the whole time we've been manipulated by chickens.
My God, it makes so much sense now. I always said they were evil little fiends.
Yeah, they are. I mean, some chickens can be lovely, but honestly, having my parents kept chickens, and some of them are real nasty little bastards.
They're buggers. Like, I was almost blinded by a chicken. It's a true sob story. They're nasty. I've always feared them. They have shifty eyes and bad intentions. They're full of malice.
And anyone
they haven't forgotten that they were once dinosaurs. That's what I'm saying.
No, they definitely haven't. They will eat their own eggs if they suddenly get the notion that they are in fact food. And then, of course, you have to kill those chickens because they'll teach it to all the other chickens. Chickens will literally eat anything that they think is food. And, you know, if you've never had cockerel spurs sort of latch into your leg, you know, they're not as harmless and pretty as they look, is all I will say. Kind of got a list of birds, so I'm just going to go through. This is by no means an exhaustive list of birds, because, you know, even David Attenborough can't get through all that in an hour.
Nope.
Look, a couple of general ones. A bird flying into your house. So a bird turns up inside your house. It's supposed to signify important news. However, mm-hmm. if it's white or it dies while it's in your house, then it's supposed to portend a death.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all like a good death omen. Yep. If a bird flies into a window, it's supposed to signify that you will meet obstacles in your future endeavours. Or, you know, perhaps you just have really, really clean windows.
Not anymore.
So, you know, there's a couple of general ones there. And there's various others, but they sort of come in more with particular species of birds. So I'm going to mention one that I happened to see when I was walking down by the river the other day, and that is a wren. A wren is supposed to signify prevention from drowning, so that was great since I was walking by a river.
Very good.
A wren is also supposedly one of the birds that can guide you through the lands of the dead.
Yes. Now that is quite peculiar, because actually almost all birds which are associated with death and with the land of the dead tend to be black.
Yes. But anyway, if you've seen a wren, a European wren, they are among the smallest of British birds. They're tiny, tiny little things, but with big, big songs. And I've always been rather fond of them. They seem to have a lot of character for their size. So obviously,
And they eat a lot as well.
They do eat a lot.
Incredible amount.
So, I mean, wrens turn up in all sorts of things. Everything from Who Killed Cock Robin, the endless, endless nursery rhyme that's kind of macabre for children, to sort of Enid Blyton stories, to various bits and pieces. I mean, I even had a wren in I Rule the Night.
Although,
admittedly, it was a dead wren.
Yes, which wasn't really that great of a of a sign. That being said, the wasn't Emmeline as well at one point compared to a wren?
Yes, and so was her mentor.
So, yeah.
I was deliberately using bird symbolism there, so the idea that, you know, it's kind of like the dark thing is both offering a gift and a threat there. Sort of, here is a wren, eat its heart, and also... here is a wren. I've just killed one of the guides of the dead. Do you really want to fuck with me? Don't say it with flowers.
Say it with a dead...
Yes. So, yeah, they turn up in lots of things. Let's go on to other guides of the dead, blackbirds, blackbirds, the songbirds, which are a species of thrush.
Blackbirds are rather interesting because they're almost also secret keepers in a lot of ways. And it was said that their song into the lands of the dead. But it's very interesting because blackbirds do actually have an incredibly varied song.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
To the point that actually most of the time you hear nice songbird and you're like, that sounds like lots of different species. It's just a blackbird, mate.
It's the blackbird running through its entire repertoire.
Yeah.
Unless it's doing that high peeping thing where it's saying, there's something in the garden! I saw something nasty in the woodshed, etc., etc. But yeah, generally they can mean protection on a family, or they can act as that their song opens the doors to the lands of the dead.
Yes. Interesting also, there's this correlation between the lands of the dead and also the lands of dreams as well.
Yes.
And the particular thing that I like about that is that blackbirds and wrens differ in terms of they have a relationship with the dead, but unlike most of the other birds that have this relationship with the dead, they're not really like big scavenger sort of birds. In terms of, you think of crows, you think of ravens, we'll get to those in a minute, and the places that they hang out, you get a lot of it's a murder of crows hanging out in a graveyard. There's this strong association getting crows and ravens and corvids in battlefields as well, you know, picking up what's left. So you can definitely understand their relationship with the dead. And again, we'll go into more detail about that later. But blackbirds have this sort of sense of innocence about them. They don't have that kind of corvid feature, which sort of makes them look a little bit mean. They've got quite sweet little faces. And only actually the male blackbirds are black. Female blackbirds are actually brown.
Yes.
As well. So they don't. I would be really interested to know then, and I think it is almost exclusively to do with their song, which has this connection with the land of the dead, rather than the way that they look.
Yes, I think there's a definite emphasis towards, you know, the blackbird song and the blackbird being a friendly guide, a helpful guide. So yes. You're suggesting that you're safe in your travels through the lands of the dead or to the next life or what have you, which is not necessarily true for other birds.
No.
As we will come to.
Not particularly. Obviously I use blackbirds in the Sons of Thestian. I use lots of birds in the Sons of Thestian. But blackbirds in particular are important because you have the Merle family. And Merle means blackbird in French. So Rufus, this was obviously done on purpose. This was done for two reasons. First of all, because Merle has a nice sort of ring that corresponds with Merlin for numerous reasons.
Yeah.
But also because of this association with the dead and secrecy and varying... and dreams, which are obviously incredibly important in the Sons of Thestian and the Homartia cycle in general.
Yeah, I think I've made references to blackbirds in my writing. The trouble is, I've done it in Irish and Welsh.
Yes.
So in Welsh, a blackbird is Mjolchan, and in Irish, it's Hlunduf, which is literally blackbird. So, obviously, they're quite a common British bird, and I was about to go off on a tangent, and I stopped myself, and I kind of want credit for that. Blackbird's quite a common British bird. It's probably the bird song, despite its virtuosity, that most people can identify, you know, if they have anything to do with the outdoors at all.
Yeah, and it's also probably the type of bird that you can easily identify if you see it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you might say, you might be able to identify a tit, but can you identify which type of tit it is or not? There's a joke there about Tories, but I'm not going to make it.
Yes. While we're on songbirds, let's just talk about nightingales a moment. I always felt that the blackbird was really shortchanged next to the nightingale. Have you ever heard nightingale song?
It's really not actually that great.
It's just peep, 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 peep. It's just that there's not very much going on there. Whereas you've got a blackbird and it's like an entire orchestra's going, and the blackbird's nightingale's just like someone with the three-string guitar that isn't in very great tune. And yet somehow the nightingale has become this great emblem of songbirds, which is a little bit unfair, probably because they sing all day and all night during the mating season. But in bird symbolism, nightingales symbolise virtue and goodness, and later became emblems of inspiration, thanks to people like Keats.
Yes. Nightingales in the Hamartia cycle in the form of the rossignol, which is what nightingale means. Because nightingales are actually also quite fierce as well.
Yeah.
They'll fight you. I mean, most birds will fight you. Robins in particular are really fighty little bastards. But for their size and the fact that we do often consider nightingales to be very sweet and well-tempered, they're feisty little buggers. So, yeah.
Definitely. Sort of on the songbird scale, you also have larks, which are supposed to symbolise new beginnings and hope. Mm-hmm. And I think this is because it's a very, very European, certainly, but very British, definitely, image of being up really, really early in the morning when the sun is just beginning to rise and seeing the larks, which are ground nesting birds, rising up out of the dew and singing. So yeah, they kind of became linked with the rising sun and therefore new beginnings.
Yes. Which makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, right. I won't do crows yet. Hawks. Hawks and buzzards are interesting. Hawks have kind of... I feel a bit sorry for buzzards. Hawks are supposed to symbolise clear-sightedness and vision and being able to see a way through a problem.
Yeah.
Whereas buzzards, which are really, really big hawks, basically big birds of prey, are supposed to signify ill news and ill luck.
Yeah. Poor buzzards.
Which seems a little bit unfair. And presumably it's because buzzards, like, you know, we don't have vultures in the UK. Or at least not avian vultures.
No.
So seeing buzzards wheeling overhead usually means that there's something down below that they quite fancy eating, and it may or may not be dead yet.
Yeah. Yeah, so they kind of occupy the vulture niche in the UK. Again, this is a bird which is associated with death, but on a different level. And it is quite interesting how birds in general have this association with death. And I do wonder if it's connected with their ability to fly as well.
I think so. There is this... in a lot of different pantheons, including the Celtic, a just generalised bird outline is symbolic of the human soul. So mm-hmm. in Greece, often a butterfly is used to signify the human soul, but over in sort of the UK and other parts of Europe, and places like Egypt, actually,
yeah,
just a bird was used to signify the human soul. And the idea of someone dying and then the, you know, there's a lot of medieval art which sort of depicts people standing around a deathbed and the person dying, and then you'll nearly always see birds, quite often white birds, sort of flying away from the scene.
Yeah, absolutely. On the opposite side of that, in terms of visual, something you'll often see when you want to show someone has died is you'll show a crow cawing or something along those lines. Strong associations, even without the mythology. These are intrinsic in our literature and our understanding of death, that you can use birds as a metaphor very easily without having to explain anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we get on to crows and ravens, I just want to mention owls. Owls are a bit of a kind of a misnomer, and it really depends which direction you're taking the mythology from. Yeah. If you're going from the Celtic route, then actually they are supposed to bring news of impending death and often failure and ill news. Whereas if you've allowed some of the Greek tradition in, then owls symbolise wisdom. Under the Celtic banner, ravens are the birds of wisdom, not owls.
Well, owls, particularly in Greece and Rome, are very interesting because they do have that duology in that actually sometimes they were meant to be bad luck. To owls in general were actually sort of meant to be bad omens as well. But as you say, they have this strong association with wisdom, and that's because of Athena, whose symbol was the owl. And again, we have this situation where she was a battle strategist. She was incredibly wise. So it's battle strategists and birds.
Yeah, we're back all about to the chickens them, again.
The chickens. This explains so chickens, much. Athena wants this. What do the chickens do? But yeah, so there is this strong association of wisdom because of Athena. Despite the fact that birds, in terms of the bird sort of kingdom, owls are not that smart. In fact, owls are pretty stupid. I love owls. I really, really do. But tiny little brains compared to the size of their skulls. And in terms of problem solving and things like that, they are not highest on the intelligence spectrum with birds at all.
No, this is true. And some of it is obviously us anthropomorphizing because they have big eyes and round, flat faces, and somehow we've managed to make that signify wisdom. Whereas, in fact, as you say, they're not. They don't have something that we would rate as human intelligence, put it that way. They're extremely adapted for what they do, which is, you know, silent death by night, if you're a vole or a shrew or something.
Yeah. That's the Scops owl. We have a lot of Scops owls in Cyprus, and they have the sweetest little song.
Yeah.
And we hear them all the time at night. And I love it because it sounds like a question and then disappointment. So they go, hoot, hoot. It's like, aww. Because they're always like, can I? Oh, no. And that's really cute. I really, really like that.
Brilliant. And
I also, in that we have very, very specific ideas of the noises that the owls make as well, that kind of the hoot hoot sound. Not trains, but owls. And I do remember one time walking with my father through the forest and we saw this huge owl. It was absolutely gorgeous. I don't know what species it was, what kind it was, but Dad immediately put his hands, cupped his hands together to make the owl sound, you know, the gentle kind of blowy whistle that sounds very melancholy sort of melody. And he did that and we looked at the owl and the owl just stared right at us and screeched.
Yeah, see, the owl over here that screeches is the barn owl.
Yeah.
And the one that makes the doleful sort of soft hoot hoot type noise, that's actually a tawny owl.
Yeah. But yeah, this one just flat out screamed at us like a harpy.
Yeah, you see a lot of both barn owls and tawny owls out near where my parents live, because it's sort of the perfect area for them. There's lots of old barns, for one thing. Strangely enough, for barn owls. I got very familiar with the sound of a barn owl, and they look so pretty. And, you know, they're the owls used in the film Labyrinth, and you're just like, oh, they're just gorgeous. And they open their beaks, and it's this harpy screech.
Sound of death, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's a deceptive call as well. I'm going off on a tangent, but I'm going to follow this one. And the whole point of, you hear a barn owl, it'll screech and it'll be nearby, and then the next one will sound like it's moved farther away. And actually, the owl hasn't moved. The owl is making the noise in a different way so that its prey believes the owl is moving away and will start moving in the grass again.
Now that's crafty.
That is crafty. They're among the most successful owls because they can throw their voices.
That's a really interesting thing. I did not know that, that owls could throw their voices. That's actually insanely cool and opens up so many creative possibilities. I love it.
Yeah. There's lots of cool things about owls, but I'm not going to go down that route again. I'm trying to stick to birds in general. So completely different, doves and pigeons. Our interpretation of doves as being symbolising love and peace and friendship comes from Greece.
Yeah.
They may have had some sort of symbolism like that following the Celtic tradition, but that actually comes from Greece because they were sacred to Aphrodite.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously if you've seen a pair of doves, a pair of collared doves or whatever, and they do get quite snuggly together. I mean, if you've seen a pair of pigeons, it doesn't look romantic at all. It's kind of like, should we get it on? and off they get. You know that our garden attracts a lot of pigeons. I can honestly say there's no romance there at all.
And yet here's the thing. Pigeons and doves are actually the same species.
Yeah, they all come from the rock dove.
Yeah. And we literally classify whether something is a pigeon or a dove depending on its size. If it's big, yeah, we call it a pigeon. If it's small, we call it a dove. But they are actually, they're all part of the same family.
Yeah. Yes, they are. Distinct subspecies now, but yeah. Okay, yeah. Let's go on to crows, ravens, and rooks. Because this will be a long one.
Ooh, can we mention magpies as well?
Yeah, magpies are also corvids.
Yeah.
So, definitely.
Okay.
We've mentioned magpies at length before, haven't we?
But... we have, but I do love my magpies, so I think we should probably talk about them again. Okay. With crows.
Yeah, crows and ravens are supposed to signify a message of great importance. If you hear a raven croaking three times on your left when you have a question, you'll achieve your goal, but not without great sacrifice, possibly a death.
Yes.
They were sacred to the Morrigan,
mm-hmm,
who was the goddess of war, military strategy, death and healing, because apparently those things go together.
Yep, absolutely.
Not a goddess to be messed with, but the crows and ravens were particularly her pets.
Yeah,
they're extremely intelligent birds. They can recognise themselves in mirrors. They can learn to use basic, tools. When I say machinery and tools, I kind of mean things like they can use door handles, they can open cages, they can problem solve. They're very, very clever and they tend to recognise people. So if you happen to make friends with a crow or a raven, it will recognise you for the rest of its life.
Yeah, I mean, people befriend them and they are... That they can become very loyal as well.
Yeah, jackdaws as well. Jackdaws, yeah, are also part of the corvidae. You don't see very many of them, although I've seen a lot more this year.
Mm.
I think their numbers might be climbing again, which is good. But yeah, they're obviously not blackbirds. They're sort of a pink and grey and a silvery blue colour, and they're very pretty. But they are actually part of the crow family.
Yeah. Crows kind of do draw the short end of the stick a little bit, because they do have so many negative kind of connotations, but they are actually quite lovely birds. As we've said, they're very smart, they're incredibly loyal, and I believe ravens, I mean, they did it in Game of Thrones, where ravens were able to kind of mimic basic words, sort of like parrots.
Yeah.
And you just think I just thought that was just Game of Thrones, but apparently they can actually do that.
Yeah.
No, which, yeah, they can. Blew my mind a little bit.
Well, I think there's some species of crow and raven actually learn to slightly mimic other birds in order to get them to come close enough for them to eat.
Good on you, mate. Good on you.
But yeah, they are lovely birds, and there's lots of mythology surrounding them. And there's hardly any children's books that don't feature a forest or something, or portents and omens and things that don't have a crow looking a bit shifty at some point.
They're always used to play the shifty characters and the non-trustworthy things.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I really liked that in Game of Thrones they were the main messengers. Which meant that they also had that, you know, dark wings, dark words was one of the sayings in Game of Thrones, which made sense because everything was bad news in Game of Thrones, including the ending. But you know what I mean? Everything was bad news. They always received bad news. Everything was always awful.
wouldn't bother writing a letter otherwise.
Exactly. Just writing to let you know things are great. Everyone's happy. Hope you're happy too. Reply soon. You know, you didn't get your crows out to do that, or your ravens out to do that. But I did like the fact that they were used as messenger birds, when more often than not, when we think of messenger birds and when messenger birds are brought up in fiction, they use doves, or they'll use
pigeons.
Sometimes they will eat birds of prey.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I mean, a lot of that is to do, obviously, with the pigeon's superior homing instinct. So you can take a pigeon from, I don't know, somewhere in France, and you can take it in a cage across the channel and then release it, say, in Whitby, and it will find its way home to its original place in France. Which, if you do that with a raven, the raven goes, well, actually, that just down there, about 3 miles away, is about a good place for a nest, so I think I'll stop there.
Yeah.
Probably because ravens are a lot more intelligent than pigeons.
That being said, I believe Vikings actually did use ravens on their boats to help them find land.
Yeah, they did. And this is something that appears in the Bible in the story of Noah and the Ark. When they're after the 40 days of rain and they're looking for land, they release a pair of ravens. On the first time, the ravens come back. And the second time, the ravens didn't. So they then released a pair of doves. And when the doves didn't come back, they knew they'd definitely found land. As you say, the Vikings used to do the same thing. They were looking for land. If the ravens were actually clever enough to come back if there was nowhere for them to land. So,
yeah, which is pretty smart, really.
Yeah, definitely.
Ravens also obviously have a very interesting role within Norse mythology in terms of carrying news.
Yeah. Do you want to follow that one?
Yeah.
You're talking about Hugin and Munin.
Yes, that's right. Hugin and Munin, who were the two ravens that worked for Odin and were basically his eyes. And they would fly around the world and they would carry back news to Odin, which meant that he knew constantly at all times. And yet still Ragnarok happened. Anyway, we're not talking about that. But I did really, I like that because it's the first time you see these birds with a very positive association and a recognition of their great intelligence as well. Yeah, they're spying. But they're not omens of death. They are actually symbols of knowledge and secrets and information.
I think they were kind of eyed a bit warily because of that, in fact, because you didn't actually want Odin rocking up on your doorstep because he was sort of ultimate punishment.
Yeah.
So despite all the very funny stories about him, he was also kind of like, actually, we don't really want to have to offer you bed and board for a night, so we don't really want your ravens to see us misbehaving.
Yeah, because he was actually a bit of a dick, to be honest. And I know we said we wouldn't talk about it, so this is just a quick honorary mention. But the only other time I've seen sort of ravens being used in such a very positive way is in Japan with Yatagarasu. Now, Yatagarasu is Garasu being raven or crow, I think it's crow, was the three-legged crow or raven who basically guided people who had great destinies. And again, it's this idea of ravens and crows being guides, having messages, having secrets that actually really interests me above this association of them just being beings of death.
I think the thing is, they weren't really symbolic of death in the sense of travelling the underworld in Celtic mythology and Brythonic mythology. They were kind of symbolism of, you know, you actually might die in this situation, which is a slightly different emphasis.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, the whole idea that, you know, blackbirds suggest ill news has largely come from that.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, this is going to be quite a large one. apparently they're still eaten in the Forest of Dean. I'm not sure how true that is, but swans. Swans have a huge place in Celtic mythology. There's simple things like a swan laying its head back across its wings suggests an oncoming storm. But swans are actually symbolic of transformation and the release of death. See, all these birds are about death, but the release of death. So they are very symbolic of the unencumbered human soul. So no matter what hardships you go through in life, no matter what sorrows, the swan symbolizes that, I suppose, that death is a sweet release. I think this comes from the myth of Deirdre, I won't recount in all its glory, but Deirdre was very, very beautiful. A lot of chieftains wanted to marry her. She didn't really want any of them. She just wanted to still be wild and free. She did love another man, though, someone who couldn't possibly have afforded to marry her, and she ran away with him. Cathelin was sent with his men to recapture her, to take her and back to the man that wanted to marry her, the one who had drawn. Basically, they all drew lots as to who would actually get to marry her. She wasn't consulting.
Charming.
She wasn't having any of it. She was just not keen. So she ran off with a man she did actually love. Cathelin was sent to retrieve her, which he did. He brought her back, and she still refused to marry this chieftain. And he said, "Well, tough. I'm going to marry you anyway." And he sent women to dress her in the finest white gown, which is very, very unusual for Celtic mythology. White was not a practical colour.
No. And had great associations with, well, death.
Yeah, with death. And bedeck her with jewels and to braid her golden hair very, very high on her head like a crown. And she was like, "Well, I'm being forced into this, and you're trying to tell me that it's not rape. It's definitely rape, because you're forcing me into a marriage with someone I don't want, I've never been interested in." So she took off all her clothes, and she let down her hair, and she refused to wear anything when she got into the chariot that was to take her to the chieftain who was going to marry her. And at the last moment, all those watching, including Cathelin himself, felt a moment of great shame, because they'd all been complicit in her being handed over to a man she didn't want, and the fact that it was actually going to be rape. And as she took a step from the carriage, there are two endings to the story. One is that she fell and struck her head on a stone on the ground and died, and a swan swept up from the ground. The other is that she didn't actually do the dying bit, she just turned into a swan and flew up into the sky. So again, the swan symbolising the release of death, and also transformation, the transformation of the spirit. And then obviously there's the story of the four fair children of Lear, who...
Yes.
There's three boys and a girl. I only remember the girl's name because the girl has the most active part in the story. Her name was Fiula. And their stepmother wanted their father for herself, and wanted her own children to become his heirs. So she lured the children down to a lake, and the boys went in splashing around happily, and the stepmother said, "Fiula, why do you not go down with your brothers?" And Fiula wasn't happy, but she had to obey her stepmother. And the minute her feet touched the water, all four of them were transformed into swans. And they travelled the world, but only Fiula remembered their human life. She was like the repository of all their human knowledge. And for hundreds of years, they were trapped like this until finally they touched down near a church. And I can't remember whereabouts it was. Somewhere in Ireland. And they were blessed by a local friar, I think it was. And when they transformed back into humans, they were all very, very old men and women. And that they immediately died. Which is a very sad story.
It is an incredibly sad story, yes.
But again, I think that one sort of, again, symbolises, you know, the swan as transformation and release and death, but also a more gentle reabsorption of the old Celtic religion into the Church of the Celtic Rite before Christianity became as rigid as it did after the Norman Conquest. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. So there's loads of swan myths in Irish mythology. There's also Ciara Eva Maith, who was a beautiful, beautiful swan maiden. So beautiful, in fact, that when one of the lords of the Tuatha De Danann saw her in a dream, he grew sick and pale and started to die for love of her. But you know,
yeah, that's
another
I can relate to that.
That story has a happy ending, although a somewhat weird one. There's a lot of swan maidens in that story, but she's the most beautiful one. Anyway, I won't recount that one as well. It's just to prove the point that obviously the swan, being beautiful and pristine and white and looking so graceful as on the mirror smooth lakes, nobody really thinks about how a swan actually eats and breeds, and the fact that they're massively, massively aggressive, and they will actually break your arm or your neck if you go anywhere near the nest.
They're real bastards.
They're not nice birds.
They're not. I just do remember sort of seeing swans and being like, oh, they're so beautiful. And my partner was just there like, yeah, they're scum eaters. They have no standard. How awful the water is. Like, everything, nothing else will go and live in that water, but swans will. Swans don't care.
Yeah, they're good with stagnant water. It's fine. There's plenty of grubs and things, so...
But they just don't care. They're actually not very clean birds at all, despite the fact they're white. They're aggressive, they're mean, and to be honest, yeah. I do like the fact that we still technically have the tradition, which is the queen owns all of the swans.
Yes.
I don't know why.
Well, they're supposedly royal birds, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's one of our quaint British traditions, along with the idea that if the ravens ever left the tower, then England will fall.
Any day now.
Oh God, don't say that. yeah, so really, really interesting. The last one, well, the last two I'll mention, they are British birds. One of them is a migratory bird, goes to Africa when it goes south in the winter, and that's the swallow. And you're thinking of things like house martins as well. Swallows symbolic of the return of Persephone from the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
If you see one before the spring equinox, it's supposed to be very auspicious. If they rest on your house, they're blessing the house with fertility and happiness. Hopefully that means creative fertility, unless you actually want actual fertility. So swallows are very specifically about rebirth. And then there's the heron. I really like herons. They're very funny looking birds. They look funny when they're stood in the water. They look funny when they're fishing with their wings outspread. And they look really, really funny when they're flying. they just do. And yeah, I've got a lot of affection for them.
Jules is taking no prisoners. They're funny looking birds. They look funny and herons listening to this. I think you look lovely. No matter what Jules says.
They are lovely, but they do look kind of fun. Have you ever seen a heron fishing? It'll stand in the water very still with its wings spread out to create shade. So the fish are like, oh, this is a nice shady spot to go up and get the flies. And then, of course, it stabs its beak through them. Which actually is kind of clever, really.
It is. Ruthless, but very clever.
They also like frogs and things. But yeah, they're the sacred birds of resurrection. And weirdly, that's one that isn't just in Celtic mythology. That travels all the way around the world. So they're also sacred birds of resurrection in places like Japan and China.
Yes. Yeah.
There is a lot of evidence that the earliest depiction of a phoenix was, in fact, a heron.
That would make a lot of sense, actually.
I mean, it's kind of anticlimactic in the sense of, wait, that's the bird rising in its glorious feathers from the fire. But if you think of a white heron rising slowly from the waters just as the sun is hitting it right, you'd have this dazzling bird that, with a little bit of imagination, might look like it was rising from flames.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are actually quite beautiful birds.
Yeah.
They're very patient as well, which is something... I think, which probably plays into it as well. They just wait for a very long time, so they do have associations with wisdom and nobility and patience and the ability to know when to strike.
Yes.
We haven't talked about magpies.
I'm sorry, let's go back to magpies.
I want to talk about magpies before we go. I like magpies. They're little scheming bastards and I love them.
As you'd expect from the crow family.
From the crow family. So, as you say, they and like the crow family, they're incredibly smart. They're also very playful.
Yes.
They do have different sort of associations, but one of the main associations with magpies in particular is with witchcraft.
Okay.
In that you have this association, and they've certainly used to give certain omens of, you know, a good harvest or and the number of magpies you see will often tell you what's going to happen. So there's the famous count for the magpies. So one's for sorrow, two's for joy. Three's for a girl, four's for a boy, five's for silver, six for gold, seven for never told. In other versions, seven is actually seven for the devil himself.
Yeah, it actually goes all the way up to 13, and it's 13, beware, it's the devil himself.
There we go, that's it. And so there is this very strong association with the devil and with witchcraft, in particular in Yorkshire. So this is based around the north. There was the strong association of with witchcraft and with evil, which is you were supposed to make a sign of the cross if you came across a magpie. In some versions you're actually meant to salute magpies instead. And just as with birds flying into windows being symbols of death or flying through windows, Scotland, you have the magpie, which if it is seen near a window, even just vaguely close to a window, signifies impending death, which is not great for me, Jules, because I do have a bird feeder by the window, which is frequented by magpies. I sent Jules a very amusing picture of a magpie just slowly edging towards me, just kind of staring through the window like, are you going to stop me? No, stealing some peanuts and then flying off.
See, we have a pair of magpies nesting in our garden. We have quite a large garden and it's surrounded by lots of trees. And we have had a pair sort of nesting here for the last, well, since we've been here, so a good 5 years. And obviously it's probably not the same pair of magpies, but they raise chicks every year and the chicks move on, or a pair of the chicks, or, you know, a chick and a new mate take over. They're really fascinating birds in a way. If they don't form a mating bond, then you tend to get pairs of brothers sort of working together throughout the winter until they get the chance to find their own mates the following year. So if you see two magpies together, they may well not be a mated pair. They may well be a pair of brothers. The females don't usually have difficulty finding mates because there's always more of a demand for female birds.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst the magpie population is obviously what I mean. But they are also, as you say, they are playful. They're also utterly ruthless. I've found several songbird nests out there after a magpie's been through. I won't describe the contents, but the reason my dad is not keen on them is because they specifically prey on songbirds.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's their nature. That's what they eat. I wasn't here for this, but Alan was, and he described it to me because he'd never seen anything like it. We get slow worms and grass snakes and things in our garden as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was looking out through the window in the conservatory and he saw a magpie swoop down and launch up into the sky with something really long and wriggly in its beak. And he was thinking, oh God, you know, what's that? And then realised it was a slow worm. And he said he watched the next 5 minutes as the magpie repeatedly whacked this slow worm against a stone in the garden to kill it. And it wriggled, so it picked it up and it whacked it again. You know, it was really very specific. And it's like if you see a thrush dropping a snail on a stone in order to get to the snail inside its shell.
Yeah.
But this obviously was a lot more brutal. And at one point it's kind of like, do I interfere? And it's like, actually, no, I'm pretty sure that slow worm is kind of fucked. Now the kindest thing is just to let the magpie get on with it at this point.
Yeah.
But this isn't a little weak bit of prey. This is something that the magpie had spotted it lying completely still in the grass and with sort of a velociraptor dinosaur instinct had worked out the shape, gone down and grabbed it while it was still too slow from its blood being cold to get away.
Yeah.
So, yes, they're kind of pretty birds. I will never be able to get over the whole, oh God, there's only one magpie, I have to salute it thing. So thanks to my grandmother for that. But
yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, the idea is, yeah, if it's one, you salute it so that it doesn't have luck. And often you'll ask it about its wife. So, because basically what you're saying is, there are two of you, I just can't see the second one, but there's definitely two of you.
Yes.
Now, I actually use magpies in my children's book. As Jules knows, no one else knows, but Jules knows. And Amelia, if you're listening, you know about this. And I didn't actually draw on any mythology for this one in terms of what I did to use magpies. And yet the general kind of response that I get is that it feels like it could be mythology. Now, I don't want to go too much into it, but I create an association between magpies and children, which I personally think actually makes a lot of sense. Because children are also ruthless. They don't have quite the level of empathy as most adults do. They just haven't developed it yet. They don't have the sense of causation. So, you know, action and cause and consequence. So I felt that so now whenever I see magpies, I sort of think of playing children. So maybe I'm a little bit more forgiving of them than you are.
No, it's not that I dislike them. It is just genuinely that, you know, these are predatory birds as well. They are part of the crow family and as such tend to be more intelligent than your average bird and utterly ruthless in pursuit of food.
Yes, indeed. But they are actually quite amazing. And I kind of like the sounds they make. Because they don't really sing, they chatter.
Yeah, you hear a couple of them. We've had four or five in the garden before at one go, usually when the chicks have grown up and the parents are sat out there. And what they all sound to me like is they're out there with tiny machine guns going rattle, 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 reload. So that's how I've always got them pitched in my head if I'm not watching them.
They're just having a war.
They're playing guns in the garden.
Aww. That's almost cute. Almost. We are running out of time. Just noticed the time.
I think we've run out of time, in fact.
Yes.
There's no running about it. That took us a lot longer to get through all those birds than I thought it would.
There are a lot of birds. There are a lot of them. Before we kind of sign off and get to our recommendation, though, what's your favourite bird, Jules?
It would be really difficult to just pick one because I tend to like all birds and animals in general. But I'm going to say the robin because it is such a quintessentially British bird. You don't see them as much in the summer, or rather you don't notice them as much, but you see them in the winter when they're getting very territorial about like staking out their claim. Other birds we've got in our garden, we have got robins, and I imagine that the pair of male robins we had out there, that one of them must have been the half-grown chick that was kind of tolerated by its elder, and they are massively, massively aggressive, and I kind of like them because of that. I think I once described it to someone as robins are the begbies of the of the bird world. And, you know, you look at them wrong and they'll ask you why you spilt their pint and attack you with their face spikes. And I'll be out cutting the lawn and the robin will follow me around. And it'll only be about 4 or 5 feet away. And it's going around picking up worms after me. And it's also kind of saying, yeah, you're in my garden. Seriously, you're in my garden. I need you out. I need you to move. And there's been other times when I've been sat on the sofa writing and the robin has come in from the front garden and actually perched on the window and peered in at me as if to say, you're kind of in my territory right now.
What you doing? Not leaving, I notice.
Yeah, but robins are actually supposed to be symbolic of incredibly good fortune and also sacred fire and productiveness. So there you go.
Learn something new every day. Well, my favourite bird, I think it wouldn't surprise anybody that I'm very, very fond of birds of prey. I really do like owls, but I obviously also really like kites, falcons, hawks, and kestrels, who are obviously a type of a falcon. I'm very fond of kestrels for obvious reasons. And finally, magpies. I think we've basically listed all the reasons why I love these birds already. But I am very, very fond of birds. So much so that I put up this little feeder outside of the house in the garden, and I just sit and watch them, and it's just such a joy.
That's hours of fun, right there.
Hours of fun. Don't need to do anything else. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, I read an advanced review copy of Moira Fowley Doyle's third book, which is called All the Bad Apples. It's actually out to buy now, so you don't have to wait and add it to your TBR. I haven't read it 6 months in advance. You can get it now. It's a really, really great book. It's gloriously queer for a start, so
yay.
That's good. And it features a lesbian main character and then various bisexual other characters as well. And what it's about is it's kind of the main character is searching on her 17th birthday. The main character discovers that her much, much older sister has gone missing, and she's so missing that everyone thinks she's dead and they actually have a funeral for her, but she's convinced her sister is still alive, and she starts following this trail of clues to try and find her sister. And this is part ghost story, part family history, part real dig into the past and the fairly recent and pretty horrible past of Catholic Ireland. And Ireland is still a predominantly Catholic country now, and some of the things that have been done there in the church's name are hideous, as with anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So trigger warnings for things that happen off page, including, you know, rape and sexual abuse, and that it's not on page stuff, but it Moira Fowley Doyle doesn't shy away from it. If you don't know about the Magdalene laundries or the infamous mother and baby homes or the Christian Brotherhood orphanages, then you will do by the end of the book.
Mm.
I knew about all of those things, and yet still reading about them brought back all my old rage, not least because I kind of come from that sort of background, so it spoke to me very, very personally.
Yeah.
And yeah, this journey the main character goes on is kind of through five generations of women who've kind of been silenced by society for one reason or another, either because, you know, they're not quite straight enough, or they're not quite male enough, or they're not quite rich enough, or what have you. It goes all the way back to the famine, the main famine, the great famine, and how these things sort of help. And I wouldn't say she's casting a lot of blame with this book. She isn't, but she's also not disguising the rage behind it as well. And
yeah,
it's also kind of a funny book. And very entertaining, and it has a couple of genuinely quite, well, for me, almost chilling, but for most people, actually chilling moments as well. You do have the spooky three Bay and Shay sisters who turn up as well, and I was like, oh yeah, well, that's totally my sort of thing. Excellent. So it's really, really good. I highly recommend all this author's books, but definitely that one. It is the best one she's written so far, in my opinion.
Brilliant. Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment telling us about your favourite birds or your favourite bird mythology, or whether you've recently had a birdie omen.
A birdie omen.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.